Welcome to the Money Maze Podcast. I'm Simon Brewer, and along with my co-founder, Will Campion, we created this show in 2020 to explore and unravel some of the mysteries surrounding the investment and business worlds. Episodes are available on audio via most podcast platforms and on video via our YouTube channel. And we're active on all major social media platforms. To stay up to date with every episode, please do sign up to our newsletter at moneymazepodcast.com. And we'd like to thank you for listening. If we could ask one favour, we'd love you to tell a friend or colleague about us. Thank you. Thought-provoking, amusing, self-critical, rich with anecdotes, laced with good advice and large servings of humility, you might not automatically assume I'm describing the book titled On Leadership, just out today and written by Sir Tony Blair. Well, sitting in the Alps in August, I read all 330 pages. And as our focus here on the Money Maze podcast is to draw out the perspectives and knowledge from our guests who occupy leadership positions in the world of finance, business and beyond, this book is really instructive. And so I'd like to start by congratulating you on a very well thought through and important book and to welcome you, Sir Tony Blair, to the Money Maze podcast.
Thank you, Simon. Thank you for reading all 330 pages. I hope it didn't disrupt your holiday too much.
Well, we're here in our offices in London, September the 5th. Thank you for making the time to join us. Before we jump in, a quick recap for those listening and watching around the world. You were born in Edinburgh. You were the youngest Prime Minister since 1812. For the historians, that was Lord Liverpool before you. The longest serving Labour Prime Minister from 97 to 07, and those 10 years as Prime Minister was the second longest continuous period after Margaret Thatcher in more than 150 years. And you left office at the comparatively young age of 54. But in our conversations, we like to have a quick glimpse of our guest's youth. So let's have a quick flashback. We met at 13, you were sent to board at Fettes, and your biographer, John Rental, reported your teachers described you as being a complete pain, and they were very glad to see the back of you. Was that because you were too smart or too rebellious?
Too rebellious, definitely not too smart. I kicked against the rules. And you know, the private school system at that point was undergoing this very tense period of change, actually. But yeah, no, I used to, when I first became Prime Minister, there would be various articles from headmasters of the past who were not particularly complimentary about my time at school.
So you take a gap year before university where you go to study law at Oxford. And I noted, because I have two daughters who are singer-songwriters, but you sang, you also did comedy. That takes a thick skin. Was that invaluable preparation?
It was, funny enough. I mean, I'd never really been to London before. I took a year off before university. My dad gave me a train ticket and £5. And I did bands and promoted bands and did some singing and some playing. And it was a great experience. It's a really good thing, if you're ever going to go into politics, to spend some time out of politics.
Yeah, and that's a point that is clear in the book. So the book, On Leadership, Lessons for the 21st Century. We're all intrigued with leadership. Is it innate, nurtured? Can we really learn it? Why did you feel the need to write it?
It was partly based on my own experience as Prime Minister for over 10 years, as you said, but also my institute now, which is quite a large organization. We've got roughly 1,000 people employed in it, and we're working with maybe 40 different governments around the world, actually slightly more than that now. And so it was also about the lessons I've learned from working with them and studying what works and what doesn't. Now, it's called On Leadership, but it's really, in a way, a study of the principles of governing. It's about leadership in the context of government, though I hope the book has got a relevance, whatever position of leadership you're in, because to answer your question, I think leadership, it's part nature and part nurture. There are things that you definitely learn, but then part of it that is that people who are prepared to step forward when other people step back, which is the essence of leadership. And I think that's the same whether you're running a country or a company or a community center or coaching a football team.
Yes, and you say this is not a book about my qualities or lack of them as a leader, but what I've learned. So if we start at the high level, we had General Petraeus on, who said you've got to get the big ideas right. And one of your themes is about priorities. And so My question is, as you advise these other governments and you're talking to often young leaders, how do you get them to think about what is the priority?
Yeah, so I think in any organization, you need a clear sense of direction. So you've got to have a destination. And then if you're going to get there, what I've found is if you try to do everything, you end up doing nothing. So you have to decide, well, what are the key things that are going to make this journey to the destination successful? What are the things I really want to be judged by? Of course, everything has its own place and importance, but what are the things that are going to define whether we succeed or we fail? And that's a process I go through with leaders. And, you know, often they'll say to me, well, here are my priorities. And I say, well, look, there are 60 of them. So I don't think you've prioritized. You know, if you're lucky, you'll get five big things done as a leader, at least in one term. And the other thing is always to say there's a difference between an ambition and a policy. When I talk to leaders and I say to them, what are your policy priorities? Even if it's a small number, they'll often say things. And then I say to them, actually, you know, those aren't policies. They're just ambitions. And ambitions are very easy to have. Policies are very difficult to devise. So you need your strategic view of your destination. And then you need to grapple with what are the practical and clear steps that are going to get you there, recognizing that you as a leader are not going to be able to focus on literally everything. Some of the things are going to be delegated to parts of your organization, but you should be focused on those things that will be critical to success or failure.
And you make the distinction early on between leaders and leadership. Tell me a little bit about how you think about that.
Yeah, because you can be in a position of leader and not really lead. One of the things I say in the book is, quote the old Henry Ford line about, you know, if I'd asked people what they wanted, they would have said faster horses rather than cars. And your job as a leader, particularly as a political leader, is not just to reflect public opinion. I mean, of course you should take account of it, but your job is also to help shape it in the interests of reaching that destination you think is right for the country. And the difference between just being in the position of leader and leadership is about leading people. It's about being out in front and taking them in a direction. The position of leader is just the office that you hold.
You have several very nice anecdotes in there. And one of them I like, which is Shimon Peres apparently leaving office, says to a successor, do you want to be in the history books or the visitors books? Now, delivery, as you say, is everything. In business parlance, it's execution. I've sat in lots of firms and heard great strategy, but actually when it comes to execution, failure. I think it was Mike Tyson who adapted von Clausewitz and said everybody has a plan until they get punched in the mouth. What advice do you offer when leaders meet resistance?
So you've got to be strong-willed enough to recognize you're always going to meet resistance. I mean, the thing I learned about making change is that when you first propose it, people tell you it's a bad idea. When you're doing it, it's hell. And when you've finished doing it, you wish you'd done more of it. That's the rhythm that I've found in government. So you've got to be strong-willed enough to overcome the resistance. But you've also got to be tactically astute in how you do that, because there's no point ultimately in being right but unable to deliver.
So before we continue this conversation, we're going to take a short break to have a note from our sponsors. Schroders is a leading provider of active asset management, advisory and wealth management services, recognized as a leader in sustainability. Few investment managers can match the combination of capabilities and global reach that Schroders offer. Across public and private markets, Schroders offers distinctive investment solutions for the diverse needs of wealth, pension and insurance clients, and the other owners of long-term assets, providing excellent long-term investment outcomes when Schroders succeeds for clients, society and the wider world benefit too. So you have this very interesting chapter on international affairs. We both know Sir Anthony Seldon, who's also been a guest, you know, on the show, has written that book, The Impossible Office on 55 British Prime Ministers. I think it's now 58. And in it, you talk a little bit about China. And you say, in retrospect, we had naive hopes of a happy ending to the rise of China. And then you add, China, however, has a significant interest in stability and significant aversion to unpredictability. And we all know China's demographic issues and other issues. If Kamala Harris calls you in November and says, what's your advice on China?
Well, I'm sure she won't, but if she did, I would say to her, I think you've got to be strong enough. The West has got to be strong enough to deal with whatever comes out of China, because there is no doubt that under this leadership of Xi Jinping, there's been a much more aggressive assertion of Chinese power, and there's been a recapturing of the Chinese state by the Chinese Communist Party in quite a traditional communist way. So we've got to be strong enough to deal with whatever comes out of China, which means that America and the West should retain military and technological superiority. But I still think we've got to remain engaged with China. I'm not in favor of trying to isolate China. I think that's a mistake. I think the rest of the world will not follow us if we try and do this, because too many countries, you know, I know this from the countries we're working in, have very strong trading relationships with China. And we need China. We need them for obvious things like climate change or global health policy. But we also need them less obviously and more. This is a more new, let me try and find the right words to describe this. But to the degree to which China is, in a sense, parked with Russia and Iran at the moment, and to a degree North Korea, we also need them as a restraining influence. So my view is you build strength, but retain engagement.
Which is why you say to achieve peace, we must prepare for war. I think you said that, and General Sanders was just a guest on the show. Why don't you expand a little bit about that? Because we've neglected in some quarters our defense capabilities.
I think the thing that the Ukraine conflict did, quite apart from everything else, was it ended the hope, and I think to a degree the belief, that the era of big power conflict was over. Because this is a situation where literally on the borders of Europe, a country was invaded with the desire to topple a democratically elected president, when it's perfectly obvious the people of that country do not want what Russia's offering them, right? They want a different path forward. So that took a lot of people, even those people like myself who'd studied Putin over the years, were surprised that Russia did this. And I think it's shaken a certain degree of complacency in the political establishment of the West. And, you know, we should take account of that now. Having said all of that, one of the other things I do say in the book is that China's a country where, I mean, I know much more about it now than I did even when I was in office, because I've gone there more often and engaged with it more often. But even today, I feel I do not understand it in the way I would like to. And I think we've got to be wary of treating China like Russia. It's not. Its political system is different. Its centers of power are different. And the leadership and its disposition towards the world today is not necessarily what will be maintained. So we should also keep part of our mind open to the fact that just as we were maybe naive in believing that as China evolved economically, it would evolve politically in our direction, so we shouldn't be blind to the fact that these evolutions occur, and they could occur in a more benign direction in the future as well.
But if that's shorthand for we don't know, that means the West doesn't really understand China. And then you take a huge and super important emerging country like India. Is this something that is very specific to China and its history?
I think so. Although you're absolutely right to point out, I mean, India is going to be the other superpower in the world. And, you know, you can see this, how it's developed under Modi's leadership. But the demographics, which you alluded to a moment ago, I mean, these are quite extraordinary, really. The Chinese population is going to shrink significantly to below a billion, possibly even down to 800 million, whereas the Indian population is set to rise to 1.4 billion. So it is going to be way and far the largest country in the world. And because it is embracing technological change, you will find ultimately, I think, a correspondence between size of population, size of GDP. And that means that India, yeah, it's going to be America, China, and India who will be the three superpowers, which is one reason why you will find around the world that other countries are trying to group together in order to be able to sit at the same table as the three giants.
Well, you talk a lot about technology and you talk about what you term the reimagined state. I had to smile because we've had a couple of interviews on crypto, but you were, I think, due to give a talk at a conference which had a crypto theme, and I think you asked your son for advice, and he gave you that book, which I think I read, which was Crypto for Idiots. And then apparently you called him on the day to run through what you were going to say, and he turned around and said, just call and say you're sick, Dad. But
good advice, which I didn't take, unfortunately.
But we have three blocks around AI, and it appears that the EU wants to regulate it, as is its propensity, possibly excessively. China is not going to let Jack Ma run loose with this, and the US, it's more of the Wild West. Now, Rishi Sunak said, how can we write laws for something that makes sense for something we don't yet fully understand? And yet, coming back to the theme which we're going to talk about is why AI can empower and in effect, how would you want to approach AI almost at a legislative level?
Well, I think there's a big risk for Europe if it tries to legislate and regulate in too heavy a way, because you can't tell how this is going to develop. I mean, we have artificial intelligence, we'd have generative artificial intelligence. We will probably within the next decade have artificial general intelligence, which is, again, a whole new frontier. So I'm more on the American side of this argument. I think what would be good, because you're right in saying China will also have its own regulatory system, which will be very much focused on control and security for the Chinese state, but on the other hand, will in certain areas be actually probably much more permissive than Western regulation, for example, in the use of data to promote technology innovation. So I think it's actually important, if at all possible, that America and Europe get into a dialogue at this, and Britain obviously has a role to play in that. Britain also, I mean, after America and China, is probably number three in the world in technology. At least we've got a case for saying that. And therefore, it's really important for us, because it's part of our economic future, that we don't misstep on regulation.
And as you sit with these governments who are after your help, but we're all learning how this technology can impact productivity and how you might be able to sidestep the way in which business were done, can you maybe give an example of how you are trying to advise?
So the thing is, if you look at the problem of Western countries today, very often you've got quite high levels of spending. So for example, in the UK, I mean, we're pretty historically high levels of spending, historically pretty high levels of taxation, and yet the outcomes from public services are poor, and the efficiency of our welfare state is poor. So by accumulating data and analyzing it properly, and I mean, I think in the end, each citizen will have their own digital identifier with which you access government services and indeed your private affairs as well, you can reduce costs, produce efficiency and better outcomes. And I can't myself see another way out of otherwise this conundrum that you're spending more and taxing more and not meeting the high expectations people have of public services. So if you just take one example from the UK in recent times, when both with COVID and with the energy crisis, the government was putting very large sums of money, subsidy for the public, I mean, huge amounts of money. In the end, tens of billions, hundreds of billions, even with COVID. With the right data system that allowed us to marry together different bits of data around housing, for example, for energy and income, and who is receiving benefits and who's not receiving benefits, we could have targeted that help much, much more effectively. We could have saved even, I mean, our assessment is on the energy alone, we could have saved tens of billions of pounds. So these things are going to matter dramatically. If you look at drug discovery and healthcare, healthcare is going to change enormously as a result of artificial intelligence. We're going to have the ability to diagnose people much earlier and to treat them much better. So you're going to have to reorganize your healthcare system much more around prevention rather than simply cure. So all of these things offer, I think, huge amounts of opportunity, provided politicians are prepared to be imaginative enough to embrace them. Now, having said that, there are obviously all sorts of downsides, and we can see this most clearly with social media, disinformation, and you know, there's lots of hugely difficult questions. But I think you can waste a lot of time deciding whether you like this, this technology revolution when it's a fact. And so the job of the government is to access the opportunities and mitigate the risks.
And you've been a champion of this digital ID, and we're known and tracked everywhere. So is the resistance beginning to ebb?
I mean, I've always thought there's more resistance from pressure groups than there are from actual members of the public. Because most people, when you say to them, look, you give Amazon or your local supermarket huge amounts of information, I think most people think, well, that's fine. And also, by the way, it's the one thing that allows you to track who's got a right to be in your country and who hasn't, which is integral to dealing with this question of immigration, which is a pressure on virtually every Western government.
So before we continue this conversation, we're going to take a short break to have a note from our sponsors. The Money Myth podcast is sponsored by IFM Investors, a global institutional asset manager whose purpose is to invest, protect, and grow the long-term retirement savings of working people. Owned by pension funds and inspired by their members, they invest in what matters. As a responsible investor, IFM actively engages with their portfolio companies on issues they care about, with the aim of improving net performance whilst minimizing risk. They manage investments across infrastructure, debt, listed equities, and private equity assets. To learn more, tap the link in the episode description below. So you have a very interesting chapter on hubris and nemesis. So pride and the fall that follows. CEOs we know around the world, it's a problem that they have. And you say you're never as knowledgeable or smart as you think you are. I testify to that. And humility, you say a leader should naturally have humility, because if it's not there by nature, it will be taught by experience. Just staying with that hubris question, when you reflect on Iraq, you say a misplaced assessment that democracy could be transplanted. But was it not arguably just a Western hubris, because that was how the West looked at its belief system and potency?
Yes, to a degree. I mean, I think that's right. But it's not that there was a bad intention. I mean, you're removing brutal regimes, both in Iraq and Afghanistan, that had killed hundreds of thousands of their people and were deeply oppressive. But whereas, for example, when we were doing this in the Balkans with Kosovo, there was enough institutional strength and enough local environment that you could seed democracy and have it grow. I mean, the truth is it was much more difficult to do that, particularly when you had Iran on the one side and various Islamist groups on the other that want to disrupt the very thing that you wanted to do.
So the foreign policy question leads into the domestic policy, as you write, particularly around immigration, which, as we know, economies depend on it. But, you know, from left and right, we're now getting rising siren calls about, you know, the immigration issue. And it struck me that one small country, Denmark, seems to be taking, for a very liberal country, quite an aggressive approach about resettling communities if they're becoming too concentrated, saying you don't get your benefits unless you sign up to childcare. Who is doing well on this thorny and unending issue of immigration?
Well, Denmark is doing well, and it's a Labour government there, so it's a centre-left government. But, you know, I have and always have a very clear view about immigration. There are people who are anti-immigrant, and they're just anti-immigrant as a matter of principle. There's not a lot you can do about that, but they're a minority. There's then a much larger group of people who are not anti-immigrant, who recognize the benefits that immigration can bring, and America has brought enormous benefits, and the UK has brought enormous benefits. But they worry there's no control, there's no rules around it. And I always say, if you don't have rules, you get prejudices. So the important thing for people in government is to recognize that this is not a question of who's racist and who's not racist. That's a bad way of looking at this argument. It's really around order. And one of the things that I don't go into this a lot in the book, but I think this is really important, that I've been thinking a lot about it recently, which is that as the world changes very fast, and partly as a result of technology, people want some order in their lives. They want to know that, okay, things will change, but I've got some decision-making control over this change. And where people feel with immigration, there's really no control, and it happens without any assessment, it happens because people manage to get into the country for whatever reason, then I think that's when they say, well, no, come on, you should be dealing with that problem. And we should decide who comes in and who doesn't. It shouldn't be an accident.
So it struck me that in what is an optimistic book, you were, if not pessimistic, you clearly comment on the fact that there are Muslim communities that have been influenced by Islamist thinking and this whole challenge between Islam and Islamism. And I was reading Ian Kershaw's book, Personality and Power, and he writes, populism is a political force capable of eroding our long-standing democratic values. And you've written, our enemy is extremism and our ally is tolerance. How does that center politically hold and reduce the heat in the narrative?
You see, the important thing, if you want to deal with populism, because you've got to be very careful with this concept of populism, because people can apply it in a very, you know, de haute en bas way to anyone who they disagree with, right? Is that what you're using? They're a populist. And by the way, there's nothing wrong with politicians wanting to be popular. Most politicians do. Populism, in my experience, exploits a grievance but doesn't invent one. Therefore, it's for those of us who would regard themselves not as populist to come up with the solutions. And if you don't come up with solutions, then the populism will grow. And we've seen this with immigration, frankly. And in respect of Islam, because I do a lot of work in the Middle East still and very active there, there, for most of the leaders in the Middle East region, the distinction between Islam, the religion, and Islamism, the political ideology based on religion, is a very, very clear distinction. And yet, I think in a lot of Western countries, we feel uncomfortable with that distinction. We feel, because of course, the Islamists are very clever at accusing anyone who disputes Islamism of being Islamophobic. And I think it's really important we draw that distinction, because Islam is a religion, fine, like any religion, right? Islamism, which is taking a religion and turning it into a political ideology, is always going to be difficult, because it's by necessity it's exclusivist, because you're excluding anyone who doesn't follow that particular view of the religion. And it goes against the modern world, which works through connectivity, through people being open to each other across boundaries of faith and culture.
That's very clearly expressed. You write, leadership is lonely and voluntary. And when you reflect on your successes, high up there is the Good Friday Agreement in Ireland. I've listened to, you know, various commentaries on how you went through that negotiation. And before I ask you about transferability, was there something about your leadership that allowed success in the end to flow?
Well, I guess there must be, but putting my finger on it, first of all, I was fortunate. I was fortunate because I had a partner in the Irish Prime Minister who was extremely able and very forward-looking. I was lucky because there was leadership both in the unionist community and in the nationalist community that were prepared to take risks for peace. But I also think, I sometimes wonder if this had happened towards the end of my time, whether I would have had that ability to think we can do something that most people thought was completely impossible. So maybe there was also part of, we were a new government, we came in with a new broom, and we thought that the thing that most people regarded as impossible was possible. Maybe later on I would have been more hesitant.
And that transferability, of course, it takes us to the Middle East, it takes us to Israel and the Palestinian question, and you know that era really well. Again, what do you think is possible and how would you approach it?
Well, I always say to people that the difference between the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and the conflict in Northern Ireland is that actually at one level, the Israeli-Palestinian conflict is more open to solution. Because even though we have peace in Northern Ireland and the Good Friday Agreement, we don't actually have an agreement as to the end outcome. You know, but still the nationalists want a united Ireland, the unionists want Northern Ireland to remain in the UK. The paradox is that for the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, there is a general consensus globally, at least, that there should be a two-state solution. Therefore, what I've come to the conclusion, because there's been so many attempts to negotiate this over the years, is the problem is not the process of negotiation. The problem is that you have to create the environment in which that negotiation could succeed, and that environment is one in which Israel feels secure, and the Palestinians feel that self-determination within a region which is at peace with Israel is their future. And those two things don't exist at the moment. The Israelis, for very obvious reasons, do not feel secure, and the Palestinians feel that they are sat upon and not able to pursue self-determination. So I have become, as one of the reasons why I was active in the UAE-Israel Abraham Accords and work with the previous American administration on it, is I think the route to peace between Israel and the Palestinians is going to lie partly through the route of peace between the Arabs and the Israelis.
And would you say in your lifetime you would be surprised if a solution is arrived at?
The only other thing that will happen, I mean, I always say this to people, if you have two peoples that are living side by side, and this is in a small bit of territory. Remember that if you took the whole of Israel and the Palestinian territories, you could fit it all within New York State. So it's a small bit of territory. And where that's true and two peoples are living side by side, only one of two things happens. They either live in peace, which is what we managed to achieve in Northern Ireland now, or the stronger one oppresses the weaker one or sits on the weaker one. And this is the choice. So I want to get back to the first.
So before we continue this conversation, we're going to take a short break to have a note from our sponsors. I'm thrilled to share that the Money Maze podcast is now sponsored by the World Gold Council. gold has been at the foundation of human civilizations and economic history, from the pharaohs of ancient Egypt to James Bond, through to its vital role in central bank reserves, gold has come to symbolize trade, culture, and currency. Discover the transformational powers of gold by watching Idris Elba's film on an adventure that explores gold's meaning and contribution to societies and economies the world over. Visit journey.gold on your browser to learn more. So practically leadership, going back to that, you said that I've been surprised, shocked, and occasionally appalled at how much I have learned since leaving office. One of the questions is, did you ever get any training?
No, but I mean, one of the reasons I wrote the book was because it is this bizarre thing where you would never have gone to your positions in the banking world or chairing various funds and so on now, and you'd never think of putting a CEO in or a football coach. I mean, imagine if you just went to the fans in the stand and said, okay, we want the most enthusiastic person here, come and manage the team. Even the other fans would say, well, that's crazy. You need someone who's been preparing for this if it's a big team. But no, in politics, it's possible to come into a really important job with no experience. So, I mean, the purpose of the book, in a way, is to say, I learned simply through experience, but it would be quite good if there had been a manual that at least I could have looked at and thought, well, I should think about that. Not necessarily do it, but at least think about it.
And you touch on this, but I'd like to just draw you out. David Schwimmer, who's the CEO of the London Stock Exchange, said on an interview, it's better to be liked than be respected. And these are forces where you are leading and you're making enemies along the way, or you're depleting your political capital. How do you think about those tensions?
Look, in the end, the job of the leader is to lead. That's the conclusion I came to ultimately. And certainly in my last years as Prime Minister, I basically pretty much did what I thought was right and thought that in the end, that's just my job. And I think in those circumstances, you're unlikely to be liked, but you can aim to be respected.
And you refer to a previous leader, Lee Kuan Yew of Singapore. And just tell me, as you met him and you talk about, what did he do as a leader that so, you know, transformed Singapore?
Yeah, he's a fascinating study because he was one of the first leaders to understand that the modern world really isn't about ideology and left and right. And still a lot of political parties in the West, because they're born out of the Industrial Revolution, think that it is, but it actually isn't in the end. And what he did was take a step back and just say, what are the policies that are going to make Singapore successful? And the interesting thing, I mean, there are two things that are interesting about this, two decisions that he took. The first is when he was building Singapore, he went out and he got the best brains from around the world to come and help. So they imported intellectual capital, and today they export it. But he was unashamed about doing that. And lots of people were saying to him, no, you can't have the British back. You know, we had all sorts of problems between the British and Singapore and the end of the colonial period and everything. He was completely unashamed about it. If a British person is the best person to help us with this, go and get them. The second thing he did, which is a really controversial decision at the time, is that everyone was saying to him, look, Singapore's come out of Malaysia. You know, we need to get on our feet. We need a sense of identity. So we should all, our schools and everything should be done in our own local languages. And he said, no, we're all going to learn English. English is going to be what we use because that's going to give people connectivity to the world. So he took these decisions just on the basis of what was right. He put aside narrow-minded nationalism on the one side, and he put aside this sort of idea, you know, of cultural identity that you had to sort of cling on to it. None of that meant that he wasn't proud of Singapore and being from Singapore. It just meant he wanted the place to be successful. And the other thing, of course, he did, which is fascinating for the politicians. I mean, Singapore politicians are better paid than any politicians in the world by probably a factor of 5 or 6, certainly in any democracy. And he was just very clear. We need good people. We need to pay them well.
Yeah, we could learn from that. I'd like to talk about religion. I think you're a man of faith. Alistair Campbell spoke of you traveling on trips, always with the Bible. And Nicky Gumbel, who's been a guest, who, by the way, says, wanted to thank you and pass on his regards for all you've done. I wondered how faith has helped you in adversity.
Well, it helps you because in the right way, it can give you a proper sense of humility because you understand you're not the most important thing in the world. And, you know, you're there for a time and then you move on and there are things and powers that are more important than you. I think it's as simple as that, really. And that can give you, by the way, temperamentally, it can anchor you in circumstances where a lot of people are trying to pull you adrift.
So you have this comment in the book. You said that you met with Henry Kissinger, the late Henry Kissinger, who said that when Nixon was leaving office past the post-Watergate scandal, and obviously was very down Kissinger said, history will be kinder to you, Richard. And Nixon replied, he said, that depends on who writes the history, Henry, which was lovely. How do you think history will judge you?
I don't know. And I honestly don't spend a lot of time troubling myself about it because there's not much I can do. And one of the things I have learned in life is it's always important not to be constantly retrospective. You know, I've got an institute now I'm very committed to. You know, I really like and enjoy the work I'm doing. And I think, you know, you can go back all the time and lots of people will write things. And in the context of the book, they'll write lots of things. Some will be complimentary, some not. But I just think if you're in a position of leadership, you're going to accept that. I always say to people, when you decide, you divide. So in the end, you've just got to recognize some people will look at you one way, some people look at you another. There's not a lot you can do about it. And in any event, every moment spent thinking about it is probably a moment wasted.
So back to the Tony Blair Institute, I was in a meeting the other day with some people from McKinsey, and they were very complimentary about some of the people who work with you. You talked about prioritizing and performance measurement. How, when you set about advising one of these governments, do they judge you?
Yeah, it's a good question. Whatever projects we do with the government, we have a series of effectively KPIs that we need to meet. And, you know, for us as an institute, it's very important that what we do is a practical impact. And I always say to the people working on our teams in countries, because we have teams of people go and work and live alongside the leader's team in any country, process is important, but only if it leads to product. So, you know, make sure that in the end, the judgment that is based on what we do is, has the country improved as a result of our work?
And I wanted to just ask about education. You're surrounded by, you know, very well-qualified people at the Institute. And, you know, the UK clearly has some fantastic centres, you know, of learning. But there's this, I see it with my son, who's now applying to a US university. There's a continued brain drain, maybe to an exaggeration. But, you know, as UK education has been squeezed and perhaps hasn't figured out the right model, now looking at education, and I say that in the context of two other daughters who have gone to, you know, other universities that were well-respected, where I think contact hours are down to 8 hours a week. And, you know, these can't be centres of excellence any longer. And the US clearly had bigger budgets, et cetera. What would you now, putting your lens on education today, what would you want to do?
Keeping our universities strong is, in my view, an absolute economic priority for the country. So this is one of the reasons we introduced tuition fees. My government did, and it was not popular, but I do think it was necessary because, you know, British universities were at risk at the turn of the century of falling behind. We're now in a situation where, again, today, they're at risk of falling behind. And these are centers of innovation. You know, a lot of the best people in the technology sphere are coming out of university. So I think it's really important we keep the university sector strong. I'm a great believer in early years education. I think it's very important, particularly for the most disadvantaged children, that they get good early years education. And then I think for primary and secondary school, up to the age 18, I think there's a massive amount that technology can do to help us here. And there are great and interesting innovations happening in education technology that we should take advantage of. I also think, by the way, I'm not, because my oldest son works now with an education technology company that is all about people not going to university, yes, but having high quality apprenticeships. I think this is also really important. You know, we need to provide choice. I focused a lot on education when I was in office, but I would say today it's even more important, particularly in an area of big change. You need people educated to be creative, to be innovative, and to be unafraid of change.
And as you scan the globe, do you look and go, wow, they're really getting it right at a country level?
Well, it tends to be the smaller countries in a way. I mean, Singapore, we just mentioned, but you've got some of the Nordic countries who are doing extremely well. But I think everyone's in a position now where they probably can educate the top half of their population really well. But if you start to go down and you look at some of the inner city education, I mean, we did a lot to change inner city education in the UK. And there are state schools in London now sending more kids to Oxford and Cambridge than Eton. And that's great. But you look at some countries around the world, I think particularly the US actually, and in inner city education is the single most important thing to give a young person. And you can't end up with education policy being determined, I'm afraid, simply by the producer interests, which are the teachers' unions. You've got to look at what is really going to work for the pupil and the parent.
So I have some closing questions. Which leader would you most like to have served under?
You know, I never answer those questions.
But they could be dead.
Yeah, well, I know, but you make one friend and a lot of enemies.
apart from your religious allusions, you have quite a few allusions in French as well, and you know that great Edith Piaf song, Je ne regrette rien. When you reflect, is there one regret particularly?
No, there's plenty of regrets, but I always say there's many regrets, but that's for me to know and others to try and find out.
And what would give you the greatest pleasure 5 years hence?
I think for me would be that Britain has rediscovered a clear sense of direction and is on the up. That's what I would like. Because, you know, in many ways, in my 10 years, it was quite an optimistic time. And I think it's a time that's somewhat darker now. And I would like to see that light come back.
Stan Druckenmiller, who worked with George Soros all those years, said that if early on in your career you get a choice between a great mentor or higher pay, take the mentor every time. Did you have an important mentor?
I did at points in my life have important mentors. Yeah, but I will say that my first mentor was really the person I did my pupillage as a lawyer, and Alexander Evan, who was a great teacher. I mean, pretty rough teaching it was at points, but really taught me the importance of intellectual discipline, of how to analyze situations and facts. And I always say to people, this is one of the reasons I say, if you're going to go into politics, spend time outside of politics first, because you'll learn some life skills that will be really important later.
And finally, particularly for our young cohort listening, if you could offer advice, just one thing, what would it be?
Get a sense of purpose. I mean, I would say to people, wake up with a sense of purpose and go to sleep at night counting your blessings, because your blessings are going to be much more than you think. And having a sense of purpose is part of what gives you energy in life.
I'm going to add, because I actually picked up your book, walked over to one of my daughters, she'll remain nameless, and I said, I want you to listen to this. It says, work hard, play hard equals the possibility of success. Play hard, work hard, virtual certainty of failure.
I know, but I don't know whether you've been any better at managing to get your kids to follow that advice than me, but it's
anyway,
definitely right.
There you are, being quoted in the kitchen. Stoneberg, thank you so much for being here today. This is not a book of self-congratulation. I think that the large doses of humility are terrific. Some of the anecdotes are very amusing. As you say, what I achieved as a leader is debatable and debated, but you are laying out guidelines, guideposts, which I think will be really important. I'm now finished with your Genghis Khan quote, which was, conquering the world on horseback was easy. The hard part was when you had to dismount and govern. And I think as we all get older, we realize that these challenges are greater than we ever imagined.
Yeah, no, true. I mean, whenever I quote Genghis Khan, people feel a certain hesitation. But actually, I always thought it was a great quote and very true.
Well, good luck with the Tony Blair Institute. And thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you, Simon.